The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 1, Section 1, continued. Cassette 4, Side 1.
None of them knew what she was supposed to be guilty of, and there was a feeling among them that people were being arrested for no reason at all. Only one woman in the whole cell knew why she was there. She was an SR. The first question asked by Yagoda, "Well, what are you here for?" In other words, you tell me and help me cook up the case. And they say absolutely the same thing about the Ryazan GPU in 1930. People all felt they were being imprisoned for no reason. There was so little on which to base a charge that they accused IDT blank V of using a false name. And even though his name was perfectly real, they handed him 3 years via a special board, OSO, under 5810. Not knowing what to pick on, the interrogator asked, "What was your job?" Answer, "A planner." The interrogator, "Write me a statement that explains planning at the factory and how it is carried out. After that, I will let you know why you've been arrested." He expected the explanation to provide the hook on which to hang a charge. Here is the way it went in the case of the Kovno Fortress in 1912. Since the fortress served no useful military purpose, it was decided to eliminate it. At that point, the fortress command, thoroughly alarmed, arranged a night attack, simply to prove its usefulness, and in order to stay where they were. The theoretical view of the suspect's guilt was, incidentally, quite elastic from the very beginning. In his instructions on the use of Red Terror, the Czechist M.I. Latsis wrote, "In the interrogation, do not seek evidence and proof that the person accused acted in word or deed against Soviet power. The first question should be, what is his class? What is his origin? What is his education and upbringing?" There is your Saprepolite committee for you. These are the questions which must determine the fate of the accused. On November the 13th, 1920, Dzerzhinsky reported in a letter to the Cheka that slanderous declarations are often given the green light in the Cheka. After so many decades, have they not taught us that people do not return from there, except for the small, brief, intentional reverse wave of 1939, one hears only the rarest, isolated stories of someone being turned loose as the result of an interrogation. And in such cases, the person was either imprisoned soon again, or else he was let out so he could be kept under surveillance. That is how the tradition arose, that the organs do not make mistakes. Then what about those who were innocent? In his Dictionary of Definitions, Dow makes the following distinction. An inquiry is distinguished from an investigation by the fact that it is carried out to determine whether there is a basis for proceeding to an investigation. On sacred simplicity, the organs have never heard of such a thing as an inquiry. Lists of names prepared up above, or on initial suspicion, or a denunciation by an informer, or any anonymous denunciation, were all that was needed to bring about the arrest of the suspect, followed by the inevitable formal charge. Article 93 of the Code of Criminal Procedure has this to say: an anonymous declaration can serve as reason for beginning a criminal case. And there is no need to be surprised at the word criminal here, since all politicals were considered criminals, too, under the code. The time allotted for investigation was not used to unravel the crime, but, in 95 cases out of 100, to exhaust, wear down, weaken, and render helpless the defendant, so that he would want it to end at any cost. As long ago as 1919, the chief method used by the interrogator was a revolver on the desk. That was how they investigated not only political, but also ordinary misdemeanors and violations. At the trial of the Main Fuels Committee, 1921, the accused, Makrovskaya, complained that at her interrogation she had been drugged with cocaine. The prosecutor replied, if she had declared that she had been treated rudely, that they had threatened to shoot her, this might be just barely believable. The frightening revolver lies there, and sometimes it is aimed at you, and the interrogator doesn't tire himself out thinking up what you are guilty of, but shouts, "Come on, talk, you know what about." That was what the interrogator Kaikin demanded of Shripnikova in 1927. That was what they demanded of Witkowski in 1929. And 25 years later, nothing had changed. In 1952, Anna Skripnikova was undergoing her fifth imprisonment, and Sivakov, chief of the investigative department of the Orjonikidze State Security Administration, said to her, "The prison doctor reports you have a blood pressure of 240 over 120. That's too low, you bitch. We're going to drive it up to 340, so you'll kick the bucket, you viper, and with no black and blue marks. No beatings, no broken bones. We'll just not let you sleep." She was in her 50s at the time, and if, back in her cell after a night spent in interrogation, she closed her eyes during the day, the jailer broke in and shouted, "Open your eyes or I'll haul you off that cot by the legs and tie you to the wall standing up." As early as 1921, interrogations usually took place at night. At that time, too, they shone automobile lights in the prisoner's face, the Ryazan checker, Stelmach. And at the Lubyanka in 1926, according to the testimony of Berta Gandal, they made use of the hot air heating system to fill the cell first with icy cold and then with stinking hot air. And there was an airtight cork-lined cell in which there was no ventilation, and they cooked the prisoners. The poet Klyuyev was apparently confined in such a cell, and Berta Gandal also. A participant in the Yaroslavl uprising of 1918, Vasily Alexandrovich Kazyanov described how the heat in such a cell was turned up until your blood began to ooze through your pores. When they saw this happening through the peephole, they would put the prisoner on a stretcher and take him off to sign his confession. The hot and salty methods of the gold period are well known, and in Georgia in 1926, they used lighted cigarettes to burn the hands of prisoners under interrogation. In Meteki prison, they pushed prisoners into a cesspool in the dark. There is a very simple connection here. Once it was established that charges had to be brought at any cost, and despite everything, threats, violence, tortures became inevitable. And the more fantastic the charges were, the more ferocious the interrogation had to be in order to force the required confession. Given the fact that the cases were always fabricated, violence and torture had to accompany them. This was not peculiar to 1937 alone. It was a chronic, general practice. And that is why it seems strange today to read in the recollections of former Zeks that torture was permitted from the spring of 1938 on. Why, Ginsberg writes that permission for physical measures of persuasion was given in April 1938. V. Shalamov believes that tortures were permitted from the middle of 1938 on. The old prisoner, M. Blank C.H., is convinced that there was an order to simplify the questioning and to change from psychological methods to physical methods. Ivanov Razumnik singles out the middle of 1938 as the period of the most cruel interrogations. There were never any spiritual or moral barriers which could have held the organs back from torture. In the early post-war years, in the Cheka Weekly, the Red Sword, and Red Terror, the admissibility of torture from a Marxist point of view was openly debated. Judging by the subsequent course of events, the answer deduced was positive, though not universally so. It is more accurate to say that if before 1938 some kind of formal documentation was required as a preliminary to torture, as well as specific permission for each case under investigation, even though such permission was easy to obtain, then in the years 1937 to 1938, in view of the extraordinary situation prevailing, the specified millions of admissions to the archipelago had to be ground through the apparatus of individual interrogation in specified limited periods, something which had simply not happened in the mass waves of kulaks and nationalities. Interrogators were allowed to use violence and torture on an unlimited basis, at their own discretion, and in accordance with the demands of their work quotas and the amount of time they were given. The types of torture used were not regulated, and every kind of ingenuity was permitted, no matter what. In 1939, such indiscriminate authorization was withdrawn, and once again written permission was required for torture, and perhaps it may not have been so easily granted. Of course, simple threats, blackmail, deception, exhaustion through enforced sleeplessness, and punishment cells were never prohibited. Then, from the end of the war and throughout the post-war years, certain categories of prisoners were established by decree, for whom a broad range of torture was automatically permitted. Among these were nationalists, particularly the Ukrainians and the Lithuanians, especially in those cases where an underground organization existed, or was suspected, that had to be completely uncovered, which meant obtaining the names of everyone involved from those already arrested. For example, there were about 50 Lithuanians in the group of Romualdas Skyrius, the son of Pranus. In 1945, they were charged with posting anti-Soviet leaflets. Because there weren't enough prisons in Lithuania at the time, they sent them to a camp near Velsk in Archangel province. There, some were tortured, and others simply couldn't endure the double regime of work plus interrogation, with the result that all 50, to the very last one, confessed. After a short time, news came from Lithuania that the real culprits responsible for the leaflets had been discovered, and none of the first group had been involved at all. In 1950, at the Kuibyshev Transit Prison, I encountered a Ukrainian from Dnipropetrovsk who had been tortured many different ways in an effort to squeeze contacts and names out of him. Among the tortures to which he had been subjected was a punishment cell in which there was room only to stand. They shoved a pole inside for him to hold on to so that he could sleep for 4 hours a day. After the war, they tortured corresponding member of the Academy of Sciences, Levina, because she and the Alilyuevs had acquaintances in common. It would also be incorrect to ascribe to 1937 the discovery that the personal confession of an accused person was more important than any other kind of proof or facts. This concept had already been formulated in the 20s. And 1937 was just the year when the brilliant teaching of Vyshinsky came into its own. Incidentally, even at that time, his teaching was transmitted only to interrogators and prosecutors for the sake of their morale and steadfastness. The rest of us only learned about it 20 years later, when it had already come into disfavor, through subordinate clauses and minor paragraphs of newspaper articles, which treated the subject as if it had long been widely known to all. It turns out that in that terrible year, Andrei Yanurevich, one longs to blurt out Jaguarevich Vyshinsky, availing himself of the most flexible dialectics, of a sort nowadays not permitted either Soviet citizens or electronic calculators, since to them yes is yes and no is no, pointed out in a report, which became famous in certain circles, that it is never possible for mortal men to establish absolute truth, but relative truth only. He then proceeded to a further step, which jurists of the last 2,000 years had not been willing to take, that the truth established by interrogation and trial could not be absolute, but only, so to speak, relative. Therefore, when we sign a sentence ordering someone to be shot, we can never be absolutely certain, but only approximately, in view of certain hypotheses, and in a certain sense, that we are punishing a guilty person. Perhaps Vyshinsky, no less than his listeners, needed this ideological comfort at this time, when he cried out from the prosecutor's platform, "Shoot them all like mad dogs!" He, at least, who was both evil and quick of mind, understood that the accused were innocent. And in all probability, he and that whale of Marxist dialectics, the defendant Bukharin, devoted themselves with all the greater passion to the dialectical elaboration of the judicial lie. For Bukharin, it was too stupid and futile to die if he was altogether innocent. Thus he needed to find his own guilt. And for Vyshinsky, it was more agreeable to see himself as a logician than as a plain, downright scoundrel. Thence arose the most practical conclusion, that it was useless to seek absolute evidence, for evidence is always relative, or unchallengeable witnesses, for they can say different things at different times. The proofs of guilt were relative, approximate, and the interrogator could find them, even when there was no evidence and no witness, without leaving his office, basing his conclusions not only on his own intellect, but also on his party sensitivity, his moral forces. In other words, the superiority of someone who has slept well, had been well fed, and has not been beaten up. And on his character, that is, his willingness to apply cruelty. Of course, this formulation was much more elegant than Latsis's instructions, but the essence of both was the same. In only one respect did Vyshinsky fail to be consistent and retreat from dialectical logic. For some reason, the executioner's bullet, which he allowed, was not relative, but absolute. Thus it was that the conclusions of advanced Soviet jurisprudence, proceeding in a spiral, returned to barbaric or medieval standards. Like medieval torturers, our interrogators, prosecutors, and judges agreed to accept the confession of the accused as the chief proof of guilt. Compare the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. Nor shall any person be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. Not be compelled. The same thing appears in the 17th century Bill of Rights. However, the simple-minded Middle Ages used dramatic and picturesque methods to squeeze out the desired confessions, the rack, the wheel, the bed of nails, impalement, hot coals, etc. In the 20th century, taking advantage of our more highly developed medical knowledge and extensive prison experience, and someone seriously defended a doctoral dissertation on this theme, people came to realize that the accumulation of such impressive apparatus was superfluous, and that on a mass scale it was also cumbersome. And in addition, there was evidently one other circumstance. As always, Stalin did not pronounce that final word, and his subordinates had to guess what he wanted. Thus, like a jackal, he left himself an escape hole, so that he could, if he wanted, beat a retreat and write about dizziness from success. After all, for the first time in human history, the calculated torture of millions was being undertaken, and even with all his strength and power, Stalin could not be absolutely sure of success. In dealing with such an enormous mass of material, the effects of the experiment might differ from those obtained from a smaller sample. An unforeseen explosion might take place, a slippage and a geological fault, or even worldwide disclosure. In any case, Stalin had to remain innocent, his sacred vestments angelically pure. We are therefore forced to conclude that no list of tortures and torments existed in printed form for the guidance of interrogators. Instead, all that was required was for every interrogation department to supply the tribunal within a specified period with a stipulated number of rabbits who had confessed everything. And it was simply stated, orally but often, that any measures and means employed were good, since they were being used for a lofty purpose, that no interrogator would be made to answer for the death of an accused, and that the prison doctor should interfere as little as possible with the course of the investigation. In all probability, they exchanged experiences in comradely fashion. They learned from the most successful workers. Then, too, material rewards were offered, higher pay for night work, bonus pay for fast work. And there were also definite warnings that interrogators who could not cope with their tasks, even the chief of some provincial NKVD administration, if some sort of mess developed, could show Stalin his hands were clean. He had issued no direct instructions to use torture, but at the same time he had ensured that torture would be used. Understanding that their superiors were taking precautions for self-protection, some of the rank-and-file interrogators, not, however, those who drank like maniacs, tried to start off with milder methods, and even when they intensified them, they tried to avoid those that left obvious marks, an eye gouged out, an ear torn off, a backbone broken, even bruises all over the body. That is why in 1937 we observe no general consistency of methods, except for enforced sleeplessness, in the administrations of the various provinces, or for that matter among the different interrogators of a single administration. It is common talk that Rostov-on-the-Don and Krasnodar were particularly distinguished for the cruelty of their tortures, but this has not been proved. What they did have in common, however, was that they gave precedence to the so-called light methods. We will see what they were immediately. This way was sure. Indeed, the actual boundaries of human equilibrium are very narrow, and it is not really necessary to use a rack or hot coals to drive the average human being out of his mind. Let us try to list some of the simplest methods which break the will and the character of the prisoner without leaving marks on his body. Let us begin with psychological methods. These methods have enormous and even annihilating impact on rabbits who have never been prepared for prison suffering. And it isn't easy even for a person who holds strong convictions. 1. First of all, night. Why is it that all the main work of breaking down human souls went on at night? Why, from their very earliest years, did the organs select the night? Because at night the prisoner, torn from sleep, even though he has not yet been tortured by sleeplessness, lacks his normal daytime equanimity and common sense. He is more vulnerable. 2. Persuasion, in a sincere tone, is the very simplest method. Why play at cat and mouse, so to speak? After all, having spent some time among others undergoing interrogation, the prisoner has come to see what the situation is. And so the interrogator says to him in a lazily friendly way, "Look, you're going to get a prison term, whatever happens. But if you resist, you'll croak right here in prison. You'll lose your health. But if you go to camp, you'll have fresh air and sunlight. So why not sign right now?" Very logical. And those who agree and sign are smart if the matter concerns only themselves. But that's rarely so. A struggle is inevitable. Another variant of persuasion is particularly appropriate to the party member. If there are shortages and even famine in the country, then you as a Bolshevik have to make up your mind. Can you admit that the whole party is to blame, or the whole Soviet government? "No, of course not," the director of the flax depot hastened to reply. "Then be brave and shoulder the blame yourself." And he did. 3. Foul language is not a clever method, but it can have a powerful impact on people who are well brought up, refined, delicate. I know of 2 cases involving priests who capitulated to foul language alone. One of them, in the Butyrki in 1944, was being interrogated by a woman. At first, when he'd come back to our cell, he couldn't say often enough how polite she was. But once he came back very despondent, and for a long time he refused to tell us how, with her legs crossed high, she had begun to curse. I regret that I cannot cite one of her little phrases here. 4. Psychological contrast was sometimes effective. Sudden reversals of tone, for example. For a whole or part of the interrogation period, the interrogator would be extremely friendly, addressing the prisoner formally by first name and patronymic, and promising everything. Suddenly, he would brandish a paperweight and shout, "Fool, you rat! I'll put 9 grams of lead in your skull!" And he would advance on the accused, clutching hands outstretched, as if to grab him by the hair, fingernails like needles. This worked very, very well with women prisoners. Or as a variation on this, 2 interrogators would take turns. One would shout and bully, the other would be friendly, almost gentle. Each time the accused entered the office, he would tremble. Which would it be? He wanted to do everything to please the gentle one because of his different manner, even to the point of signing and confessing to things that had never happened. 5. Preliminary humiliation was another approach. In the famous cellars of the Rostov on the Don GPU, House 33, which were lit by lens like insets of thick glass in the sidewalk above the former storage basement, prisoners awaiting interrogation were made to lie face down for several hours in the main corridor and forbidden to raise their heads or make a sound. They lay this way, like Muslims at prayer, until the guard touched a shoulder and took them off to interrogation. Another case. At the Lubyanka, Alexandra O. Blank VA refused to give the testimony demanded of her. She was transferred to Lefortovo. In the admitting office, a woman jailer ordered her to undress, allegedly for a medical examination, took away her clothes, and locked her in a box, naked, At that point, the men jailers began to peer through the peephole and to appraise her female attributes with loud laughs. If one were systematically to question former prisoners, many more such examples would certainly emerge. They all had but a single purpose, to dishearten and humiliate. 6. Any method of inducing extreme confusion in the accused might be employed. Here is how FIV from Krasnogorsk, Moscow province, was interrogated. This was reported by IAP blank EV. During the interrogation, the interrogator, a woman, undressed in front of him by stages, a striptease, all the time continuing the interrogation as if nothing were going on. She walked about the room and came close to him and tried to get him to give in. Perhaps this satisfied some personal quirk in her, but it may also have been cold-blooded calculation, an attempt to get the accused so muddled that he would sign. And she was in no danger. She had her pistol, and she had her alarm bell. 7. Intimidation was very widely used and very varied. It was often accompanied by enticement and by promises which were, of course, false. In 1924, "If you don't confess, you'll go to the Solovetsky Islands. Anybody who confesses is turned loose." In 1944, "Which camp you'll be sent to depends on us. Camps are different. We've got hard labor camps now. If you confess, you'll go to an easy camp. If you're stubborn, you'll get 25 years in handcuffs in the mines." Another form of intimidation was threatening a prisoner with a prison worse than the one he was in. "If you keep on being stubborn, we'll send you to Lefortovo, if you are in the Lubyanka, to Sukhanovka, if you are at Lefortovo. They'll find another way to talk to you there." You have already gotten used to things where you are. The regimen seems to be not so bad. And what kind of torments await you elsewhere? Yes, and you also have to be transported there. Should you give in? Intimidation worked beautifully on those who had not yet been arrested, but had simply received an official summons to the Bolshoi Dom, the big house. He, or she, still had a lot to lose. He, or she, was frightened of everything, that they wouldn't let him or her out today, that they would confiscate his or her belongings or apartment. He would be ready to give all kinds of testimony and make all kinds of concessions in order to avoid these dangers. She, of course, would be ignorant of the criminal code, and at the very least, at the start of the questioning, they would push a sheet of paper in front of her with a fake citation from the code. "I have been warned that for giving false testimony, 5 years of imprisonment." In actual fact, under Article 95, it is 2 years. "For refusal to give testimony, 5 years. In actual fact, under Article 92, it is up to 3 months. Here, then, one more of the interrogator's basic methods has entered the picture, and will continue to re-enter it. 8. The lie. We lambs were forbidden to lie, but the interrogator could tell all the lies he felt like. Those articles of the law did not apply to him. We had even lost the yardstick with which to gauge what does he get for lying. He could confront us with as many documents as he chose, bearing the forged signatures of our kinfolk and friends, and it would be just a skillful interrogation technique. Intimidation through enticement and lies was the fundamental method for bringing pressure on the relatives of the arrested person when they were called in to give testimony. "If you don't tell us such and such," whatever was being asked, "it's going to be the worse for him. You'll be destroying him completely." How hard for a mother to hear that. Under the harsh laws of the Tsarist Empire, close relatives could refuse to testify. And even if they gave testimony at a preliminary investigation, they could choose to repudiate it and refuse to permit it to be used in court. And curiously enough, kinship or acquaintance with a criminal was never in itself considered evidence. "Signing this paper," pushed in front of the relatives, "is the only way you can save him. Destroy him." 9. Playing on one's affection for those one loved was a game that worked beautifully on the accused as well. It was the most effective of all methods of intimidation, One could break even a totally fearless person through his concern for those he loved. Oh, how foresighted was the saying, a man's family are his enemies. Remember the Tatar who bore all his sufferings, his own and those of his wife, but could not endure his daughters. In 1930, Rimalis, a woman interrogator, used to threaten, "We'll arrest your daughter and lock her in a cell with syphilitics." And that was a woman. They would threaten to arrest everyone you loved. Sometimes this would be done with sound effects. Your wife has already been arrested, but her further fate depends on you. They are questioning her in the next room. Just listen. And through the wall, you can actually hear a woman weeping and screaming. After all, they all sound alike. You're hearing it through a wall, and you're under terrific strain and not in a state to play the expert on voice identification. Sometimes they simply play a recording of the voice of a typical wife, soprano or contralto, a labor-saving device suggested by some inventive genius. And then, without fakery, they actually show her to you through a glass door as she walks along in silence, her head bent in grief. Yes, your own wife in the corridors of state security. You have destroyed her by your stubbornness. She has already been arrested. In actual fact, she has simply been summoned in connection with some insignificant procedural question and sent into the corridor at just the right moment after being told, "Don't raise your head or you'll be kept here." Or they give you a letter to read, and the handwriting is exactly like hers. "I renounce you. After the filth they have told me about you, I don't need you any more." And since such wives do exist in our country, and such letters as well, you are left to ponder in your heart, is that the kind of wife she really is? The interrogator Goldman, in 1944, was trying to extort testimony against other people from V.A. Korneyeva with the threat, "We'll confiscate your house and toss your old women into the street." A woman of deep convictions and firm in her faith, Korneyeva had no fear whatever for herself. She was prepared to suffer. But given our laws, Goldman's threats were all too real, and she was in torment over the fate of her loved ones. When, by morning, after a night of tearing up rejected depositions, Goldman began to write a fourth version accusing Korneyeva alone, she signed it happily and with a feeling of spiritual victory. We fail to hang on to the basic human instinct to prove our innocence when falsely accused. How can we there? We were even glad when we succeeded in taking all the guilt on our own shoulders. Today, she says, after 11 years during rehabilitation proceedings, they let me reread those depositions, and I was gripped by a feeling of spiritual nausea. What was there to be proud of? I myself, during the rehabilitation period, felt the very same way on hearing excerpts from my earlier depositions. As the saying goes, they bent me into a bow and I became someone else. I did not recognize myself. How could I have signed them and still think I had not gotten off too badly? Just as there is no classification in nature with rigid boundaries, it is impossible rigidly to separate psychological methods from physical ones. Where, for example, should we classify the following amusement? 10. Sound effects. The accused is made to stand 20 to 25 feet away and is then forced to speak more and more loudly and to repeat everything. This is not easy for someone already weakened to the point of exhaustion. Or two megaphones are constructed of rolled-up cardboard and two interrogators coming close to the prisoner bellow in both ears, "Confess, you rat!" The prisoner is deafened. Sometimes he actually loses his sense of hearing. But this method is uneconomical. The fact is that the interrogators like some diversion in their monotonous work, and so they vie in thinking up new ideas. 11. Tickling. This is also a diversion. The prisoner's arms and legs are bound or held down, and then the inside of his nose is tickled with a feather. The prisoner writhes. It feels as though someone were drilling into his brain. 12. A cigarette is put out on the accused's skin, already mentioned above. 13. Light effects involve the use of an extremely bright electric light in the small, white-walled cell or box in which the accused is being held. a light which is never extinguished. The electricity saved by the economies of schoolchildren and housewives. Your eyelids become inflamed, which is very painful, and then in the interrogation room searchlights are again directed into your eyes. 14. Here is another imaginative trick. On the eve of May the 1st, 1933, in the Khabarovsk GPU, for 12 hours, all night, Cheboterayev was not interrogated, no, but was simply kept in a continual state of being led to interrogation. Hey, you, hands behind your back! They led him out of the cell, up the stairs, quickly, into the interrogator's office. The guard left, but the interrogator, without asking one single question, and sometimes without even allowing Cheboterayev to sit down, would pick up the telephone. Take away the prisoner from 107! And so they came to get him and took him back to his cell. No sooner had he lain down on his board bunk than the lock rattled. Cheboterayev, to interrogation, hands behind your back. And when he got there, take away the prisoner from 107. For that matter, the methods of bringing pressure to bear can begin a long time before the interrogator's office. 15. Prison begins with the box, in other words, what amounts to a closet or packing case. The human being who has just been taken from freedom, still in a state of inner turmoil, ready to explain, to argue, to struggle, is, when he first sets foot in prison, clapped into a box, which sometimes has a lamp and a place where he can sit down, but which sometimes is dark and constructed in such a way that he can only stand up, and even then is squeezed against the door. And he is held there for several hours, or for half a day, or a day. During those hours, he knows absolutely nothing. Will he perhaps be confined there all his life? He has never in his life encountered anything like this, and he cannot guess at the outcome. Those first hours are passing when everything inside him is still ablaze from the unstilled storm in his heart. Some become despondent, and that's the time to subject them to their first interrogation. Others become angry, and that, too, is all to the good, for they may insult the interrogator right at the start or make a slip. And it will be all the easier to cook up their case. 16. When boxes were in short supply, they used to have another method. In the Novocherkassk NKVD, Yelena Strutinskaya was forced to remain seated on a stool in the corridor for 6 days, in such a way that she did not lean against anything, did not sleep, did not fall off, and did not get up from it. 6 days. Just try to sit that way. 6 hours. Then again, as a variation, the prisoner can be forced to sit on a tall chair, of the kind used in laboratories, so that his feet do not reach the floor. They become very numb in this position. He is left sitting that way from 8 to 10 hours. Or else, during the interrogation itself, when the prisoner is out in plain view, he can be forced to sit in this way, as far forward as possible on the front edge. Move further forward! Further still, of the chair, so that he is under painful pressure during the entire interrogation. He is not allowed to stir for several hours. Is that all? Yes, that's all. Just try it yourself. 17. Depending on local conditions, a divisional pit can be substituted for the box, as was done in the Gorokhovets army camps during World War II. The prisoner was pushed into such a pit, 10 feet in depth, 6.5 feet in diameter, and beneath the open sky, rain or shine, this pit was for several days both his cell and his latrine. And 10.5 ounces of bread and water were lowered to him on a cord. Imagine yourself in this situation just after you have been arrested, when you're all in a boil. Either identical orders to all special branches of the Red Army, or else the similarities of their situations in the field, led to broad use of this method. Thus, in the 36th Motorized Infantry Division, a unit which took part in the Battle of Khalkhin-Gol, and which was encamped in the Mongolian desert in 1941, a newly arrested prisoner was, without explanation, given a spade by Chief of the Special Branch Samulyev, and ordered to dig a pit the exact dimensions of a grave. Here is a hybridization of physical and psychological methods. When the prisoner had dug deeper than his own waist, they ordered him to stop and sit down on the bottom. His head was no longer visible. One guard kept watch over several such pits, and it was as though he were surrounded by empty space. This evidently is a Mongolian theme. In the magazine Niva, March 15, 1914, page 218, there is a drawing of a Mongolian prison. Each prisoner is shut in a separate trunk, with a small opening for his head or for food. A jailer patrols between the trunks. They kept the accused in this desert with no protection from the Mongolian sun and with no warm clothing against the cold of the night, but no torches. Why waste effort on torches? The ration they gave was 3.5 ounces of bread per day and 1 glass of water. Lieutenant Chulpenyev, a giant, a boxer, 21 years old, spent a month imprisoned this way. Within 10 days he was swarming with lice. After 15 days, he was summoned to interrogation for the first time. 18. The accused could be compelled to stand on his knees, not in some figurative sense, but literally, on his knees, without sitting back on his heels, and with his back upright. People could be compelled to kneel in the interrogator's office or the corridor for 12, or even 24, or 48 hours. The interrogator himself could go home, sleep, amuse himself in one way or another. This was an organized system. Watch was kept over the kneeling prisoner, and the guards worked in shifts. That, after all, is how somebody's career was launched, standing guard over a prisoner on his knees. And now, in all probability, that somebody has attained high rank, and his children are already grown up. What kind of prisoner was most vulnerable to such treatment? One already broken, already inclined to surrender. It was also a good method to use with women. Ivanov Razumnik reports a variation of it. Having set young Lord Kipanitsi on his knees, the interrogator urinated in his face. And what happened? Unbroken by anything else, Lord Kipanitsi was broken by this. Which shows that the method also worked well on proud people. 19. Then there is the method of simply compelling a prisoner to stand there. This can be arranged so that the accused stands only while being interrogated, because that, too, exhausts and breaks a person down. It can be set up in another way, so that the prisoner sits down during interrogation, but is forced to stand up between interrogations. A watch is set over him, and the guards see to it that he doesn't lean against the wall, and if he goes to sleep and falls over, he is given a kick and straightened up. Sometimes even one day of standing is enough to deprive a person of all his strength, and to force him to testify to anything at all. 20. During all these tortures, which involved standing for 3, 4, and 5 days, they ordinarily deprived a person of water. The most natural thing of all is to combine the psychological and physical methods. It is also natural to combine all the preceding methods with 21. Sleeplessness, which they quite failed to appreciate in medieval times. They did not understand how narrow are the limits within which a human being can preserve his personality intact. Sleeplessness, yes, combined with standing, thirst, bright light, terror, and the unknown. What other tortures are needed? Befogs the reason, undermines the will, and the human being ceases to be himself, to be his own I. As in Chekhov's I Want to Sleep. But there it was much easier, for there the girl could lie down and slip into lapses of consciousness, which even in just a minute would revive and refresh the brain. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.